Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg in 54 minutes. Right now, you're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we take a look at the latest announcement by National Treasury that they are lifting some of the red tape around public-private deals or partnerships in an effort to bolster that from an infrastructure perspective. We're going to be speaking to Chief Economist at Efficient Group, Adavi Root, around that. Then we've got a conversation with Peter Major of Modern Corporate Solutions around the latest impending steel and aluminium tariffs that are set to be imposed by President Donald Trump in the US. We're going to take a look at the potential impact of those tariffs on South Africa as well as on other markets around the world. We've also got a conversation with BMW South Africa around their latest launch from their Rosslyn plant. We're going to be seeing how that 4.2 billion rand investment into that Rosslyn plant is shaping up. And then we're going to wrap up the show with a sense of with an agri segment. We did property last week, so it's agri this week. We're going to be taking a look at the diseases and pests that are plaguing farmers in the citrus space and how that could potentially affect them from a legal perspective as well.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
No, I have not forgotten. We usually start the show off with strange laws from around the world. That's what we're doing this week and possibly for the rest of the year as well. Today's strange law comes from Australia. In Australia, it is considered disrespectful to disturb a religious service, funeral, or wedding. You can be fined up to $10,000 if you do. Keep that in mind the next time you're thinking of screaming at the spider that's looking at you when you're in Australia, because more than likely that's what will be there. But we move on to markets. We move straight into what's been happening in the markets throughout the day, and I'm joined on the line by Head of Research at F&B Wealth and Investments, Chantel Marks, to take a look at this. Good evening, Chantel. Lovely to catch up with you, as always. Interesting day on the market side. Yesterday was a positive day for equity markets. Today was a bit of a mixed day, seemingly some uncertainty there, but gold price is still holding above the $2,900 an ounce level. Markets clearly still waiting on a lot of information, but also maybe a little nervous.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why you see markets down but gold up, because I think that uncertainty really coming through in investors' decision making. And I mean, nothing is more uncertain than what President Donald Trump will do next. And today we got word that those 25% tariffs on aluminium and steel products has been implemented. So that put into question what is going to be his next surprise move. But I don't think anything can be very surprising right now. Nevertheless, I think it actually went better on the local market than we would have expected today. A little bit of a lift towards the close. The Industrial 25 up, probably the Rand hedges helping us out a little bit. I know Naspers and Prosus, not contributing much towards the end of at the end of the day, but Naspers pushing a little bit higher towards the end of the day. Richemont, AB InBev, and British American Tobacco really helping us out today.
Chantel, I've been keeping an eye on Sasol for the last 2 days or so. It had a really weird spike down to almost below 70 Rand, around 72 Rand a share, I think. We're back above 80 Rand a share. Are we still kind of concerned about the Sasol share price at the moment? I mean, they did give us that profit warning, which the market, by and large, had anticipated up to that point. Is it something that you have been keeping an eye on over the last couple of days? I mean, I see the stock was down about 1% or so at some point, but it did close out the day in positive territory quite significantly.
Yeah, look, you have to keep an eye on Sasol because everyone's talking about Sasol at the moment, when the possible bottom can be. And I think what we've seen over the last couple of days is perhaps some speculative buying coming into Sasol. I mean, after that trading update, the stock was trading on a forward P of 2.2 times. It's cheap as chips, but obviously we don't really know what the future holds for them. There's a lot of uncertainty in there, and that's why the stock has been so cheap. But I think it does offer a compelling investor opportunity for some of the speculators out there, and perhaps even for long-term investors who still believe in the very long-term story for the stock.
Mm. Chantal, what long-term story are you believing in at the moment? What are you looking at from a global perspective, but more especially from a South African perspective?
So from a South African perspective, I am still buying the longer term reform agenda. I think we're moving in the right direction in terms of economic reforms. And for now, I'm still positive that we can really kind of lift the potential growth rate. The execution is going to be key, but we've already seen signs of execution. So if you go on the Operation Vulindlela website, it really is great because it does show you some of the work that has been done on the reform agenda. So for that reason, I'm still quite positive longer term on kind of the SA industrial space as well as the SA consumer space. But I would concede that there could be near-term volatility, particularly because of heightened uncertainty around the US position around South Africa. Which I think is quite precarious now and has muddied the water somewhat. And then from a longer term perspective, I really do still think that the AI story is in its infancy. Whether or not the way that you play it is through chips or through some of the software solutions providers, I think that remains kind of up in the air. Whether you pick the hyperscalers or you look for the small and new emerging players in that space like Palantir or Supermicro or AST Space Mobile, I think that these are that it's a theme that will probably see us through for the next decade or so, and one worth exploring and deciding where you want to put your money to play that theme.
Chantal, you touched on Naspers and Processors' performances throughout the day, and I see that we got some updates from them regarding their share repurchase programs. Are they still going according to plan?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So they continue to buy back shares. It's part of a broader strategy to try and narrow the discount that the companies trade at relative to their underlying holdings. And I don't see that stopping anytime soon. Management still thinks that the stock is undervalued because that discount is so large. Other kind of levers that they are starting to pull is a bit of portfolio management. So they are looking at realizing value from some of their investments. Some of their investments have investments that are listing that makes it a little bit easier to value. And I think that the Tencent story still remains key, yeah, but then they're going to try not to be as exposed to just Tencent in future. And I think that that's going to be very important to get that value unlock actually materializing over time.
Chantal, another SENS announcement we got was from Tongaat Hewlett. They're obviously under business rescue at the moment. We know that we're expecting certain updates, and they gave us an update around some of the transactions that are happening there. What's going on?
Yeah, so I mean, they're basically trying to get the sale of the business kind of finalized, and then they're also trying to sell certain sections of that business. I think from a Tongaat Hewlett equity shareholder perspective, there's not really much in it for them. I think at this point in time, the focus really is on stabilizing the business and making sure that there is a business to be saved so that jobs won't be lost. And from an industry perspective, I think it's quite important that the company remains operational. But I think from an equity investment perspective, I would expect things to go kind of the way that we saw it go for Group 5, Basil Reed, some of the other companies that went into business rescue, the airlines, Com Air, One Time, just kind of quietly disappears and you accept the fact that you won't realize much value from the share.
Some of the other things that happened today, I mean, I kept up with, production update that was given by Impala. I didn't see anything too surprising there. The market didn't seem too excited about it. The share price losing quite a bit of ground on the day's trade, but recovering it all back sort of towards the end of the day and closing the day out only marginally in the red. What was the concern in that update?
I think the concern was that the profitability will be under pressure by more than what was anticipated. So, I mean, we knew that PGM prices were low. We knew that the rand was strengthening. I was actually quite surprised that they managed to push through an improvement in production, and some of their units really did quite well. They also mentioned some operational efficiency gains, which I think is quite positive. But the market seems to get this wrong with most of the PGM players in particular, where they kind of overestimate the average dollar and rand basket price that that these companies will receive for their product. And a lot of it just has to do with you don't know exactly what the sales prices are going to be and when exactly those sales are going to take place. So I think a lot of analysts take like an average over the year and think that that's going to be the PGM basket price or assume it's going to be very close to that. But that can really disappoint. And I think in this case, the price that they received for their product was a little bit disappointing and kind of drove the earnings miss and hence the share price reaction.
Mm. Chantal, before I let you go, do you think that price or the average price from Impala's perspective would be affected now that we know that those tariffs are going to be implemented, at least from a future earnings perspective? Obviously, everything that's happened in the past has now been put down on pen and paper. But do you think that these new tariffs could potentially be to the benefit of someone like Impala?
Well, I guess it depends on what is tariffed, right? So if PGMs are exempt from tariffs, right? So Impala exports a lot of their PGM production from Canada to the US. If they're exempt, I don't see that being much of a difference. If the tariffs are applied, I see the marketers kind of having to deal with that rather than Impala themselves. I think the biggest beneficiary of potential tariffs on PGMs will probably be Sibanye-Stillwater because they have producing mines in the US itself. So for Impala, it's a little bit difficult to say. I wouldn't see it being having a major impact, except if that sourcing is going to really be quite positive from a Sibanye perspective. But they can only produce so much, right? And now with the US president wanting to bring a lot of manufacturing back onshore, you're going to need the raw materials. And the best place to get it, I guess, if you're not getting it in the US itself, is from Canada.
That's going to be an interesting thing to keep an eye on. We will certainly do that. Thank you so much, Chantal, as always, for the time and for the insights. A lovely catching up with you. Chantal Marks, Head of Research at FNB Wealth and Investments, on some of the market movements throughout the day, as well as some of the SENS announcements we got from some companies.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Some investors prefer to build their own portfolios using a range of specialist funds, but for most investors, a holistically managed global balanced fund is a more effective way to manage risk and achieve real long-term returns. Tune into the SAFM Market Update tomorrow evening at 6:45 as Nick Curtin, Joint Head of Institutional Clients at Allan Gray, joins me to explore balanced funds and unpack the long-term benefits of high equity, multi-asset portfolios over time. Brought to you by Allan Gray, more than 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So ahead of next week's budget speech, National Treasury has given us quite an interesting announcement around the efforts they have put in place to cut some of the red tape that has existed in public-private partnership deals, particularly focusing on infrastructure deals or aimed at boosting infrastructure spending rather, but particularly focused on deals under 2 billion rand. I'm joined on the line by Chief Economist at Efficient Group, Davi Ruit, to take a look at this. Davi, good evening. Lovely to catch up with you as always. Interesting timing of this particular announcement. What do you make of the particular amendments that have been put forward here by National Treasury?
Well, good evening to you. I think it's good news, broadly speaking, and it's just after the SONA. I think the specific legislation was signed the day after the State of the Nation address by the President. I think it's good news, and obviously what is happening, the signal at least that the government is sending is that they want to make it easier for the private sector to participate in all sort of, especially infrastructural investment deals. I think much of the reasoning behind this comes probably from Transnet, I guess some from Eskom as well, but probably a lot of this comes from Transnet, where they are the new management at Transnet, which is that not that new anymore, though, that they certainly would want to get private sector participation as much as possible. So generally speaking, I would say this is good news.
From a government perspective or government department perspective, does this look like it'll be something that will have limitations? I mean, you touch on Transnet, you touch on Eskom. We know that there are other departments like Department of Transport. Is this limited to a certain to any departments, or is this just a government-wide sweep to say all government engagements would be benefiting?
No, all government engagements will be benefiting, so this is broad-based. Any government agency, or state-owned enterprises, various state departments, all of those will be included in this, as far as I understand. So it will make life much, much easier for everybody that participate in this public-private partnerships.
Well, Mdavi, when we take a look at the implications that these amendments then have for foreign direct investment, you touched on this to say that we're trying to obviously become more appealing to international markets.
Yeah.
Does this setup or do these amendments now then better position us for things like, obviously, the grey listing is something we've had to navigate over the last couple of years. But overall, we've been trying to get this economy restarted, and infrastructure and turning us into a construction site has been the way to go. Does this, from a FDI perspective, then say this is the key, or do we need to hear more?
No, this is not going to make much of a difference as far as that is concerned. As far as the grey listing goes, grey listing, there are other things that we need to do to get us off the grey listing. The single most important thing that we need to do is simply to implement the Zondo Commission's report, what Zondo said we should be doing. Do that and we will be off the grey list before the end of this year. But this is nothing to do with the grey listing. Will it make South Africa more attractive? Certainly it will make it a little bit more easier in some instances to invest. It will make it quicker because they are less red tape. But of course, you open the possibility of more corruption as well. But certainly, it will make it a little bit more attractive. But is this the magic wand? Is this going to lead to this massive inflow of investment in South Africa? And the answer to that is certainly no. We need to make some significant other changes in the economy. We have to grow the economy much, much faster. That means we need a government with a different ideology, different policies. We need a government with that is much more efficient. We need much, much less corruption. And I'm afraid if you look where the South African economy or how we performed the past 10, 15 years or so, we simply did not do that well. And I'm afraid this year economic growth is also not going to get to that magic 3% that the president promised us. So economic growth is the real thing that attracts investors, and the South African economy is not growing, and the South African economy is unlikely to grow much faster than, say, 1.5% this year. This is a little bit, it will add a little bit to economic growth, it will make life a little bit easier, but that's not the real answer. The real answer is we have to make some significant structural adjustments to the economy before we can get economic growth going, and before we will really make South Africa attractive as an investment destination.
You mentioned 1.5% economic growth seemingly being the upper side of what you see as optimistic or realistic, rather. I know there have been a lot of conversations around potentially getting to 3%, and that seems like a long stretch from 1.5%. But as you said, it's some of the simple things that can get us to that. Do you think that some of those simple things would be addressed in next week's budget speech, perhaps?
Well, a couple of things that I suspect we're going to hear in the budget. If you look at the revenue side, remember the state needs a lot of money. We're running a huge fiscal deficit. We've got debt levels that become unsustainable, so they need more money. They can't really cut back on state expenditure. And getting more money is going to be extremely difficult, especially with an economy that's not growing. And on top of all of that, we're probably over the so-called Laffer curve. And if you increase taxes on personal income taxes, for example, you probably will be getting less. So the major things will be on the expense side, the expenditure side of the budget of the Minister of Finance. We know, for instance, there will be a new fund, the 20 billion rand BEE fund. No, that's the wrong way to go about trying to get this economy to grow. Because are you going to fund that? This money will be earmarked for a specific part of the population, which is wrong. We know what's been happening in the past week or two with Donald Trump as an example. So that's the wrong approach. What we need to do is we have to make sure that we create a very attractive investment destination in South Africa and make South Africa an attractive investment destination, which includes much, much lower taxes, not what we have currently. The tax base in South Africa is extremely narrow. Very few people pay just about all the taxes. The state in South Africa is exceptionally inefficient, and I can give you all sort of numbers. Education comes to mind. Education in South Africa is the biggest expense item, but the quality is not only bad, it's often the worst in the world. That's a wastage of money. And many other examples. So what we need to do, we have to privatize things like Eskom and other parasitals. I call them the parasitals. We have to improve the efficiency of the state. We have to get rid of the silly things like, for example, expropriation or theft. That's what it is. Expropriation without compensation is nothing but theft. We have to get rid of all BEE legislation in South Africa, and we have to put South Africa on a growth trajectory. We're not doing that. So I'm afraid economic growth, we're not going to see Well, if we see more than 1.5%, I think we should consider ourselves very lucky. In the meantime, the orange guy is threatening us with all sort of sanctions. If he removes South Africa from AGOA, that's 0.2% off of economic growth. If he puts some more sanctions on South Africa, that's another 0.4% off of economic growth. If he decides to put some financial sanctions on South Africa, that means the rand's going to go pick a number, the bond market's going to go to another pick a number, inflation and everything that goes with that. And then we're going to be forced down to 0% economic growth. So no, we are in a very dangerous place where we are. We have to understand this, whether you like Donald Trump or not. He's the most powerful man in the world, and he's got a certain agenda. Make sure you police his ego, and make sure you stay on the right side of Donald Trump. He can do a lot of damage to this economy.
That definitely is the case from an American perspective. There's no denying America's presence in the global economy. Mdavi, before I let you go, I want to take a look at this backlog that we've got. So we're trying to encourage infrastructure. We're trying to stimulate things. But we've got a backlog of projects that have not been done.
Yeah.
And we say that lifting these sorts of red tapes and trying to encourage these things is a good way to tackle that. But it doesn't address the backlog.
I don't like the PPPs. The PPPs, as far as I'm concerned, is a bit of a contradiction. What we need to do is that they say we want to build a bridge build, for example, put it out for tenders, get the best tender out there, and you don't use silly things like, for example, all sort of social objectives that you want to achieve. You get the best tender out there and give them the tender, and that's it, and let them go and build it. You don't need the state's participation in that. You just need the private sector to build a bridge or a railroad or whatever the case may be. You do not need a partnership between the state and the private sector. Let the private sector do that. They can do it much better.
Mm. Can I get your thoughts on an unrelated matter, unrelated to these public-private partnership deals, around the interest rates conversation? Inflation's come down. South Africa's inflation is, for the first time, looking remarkably impressive, and yet interest rates are not matching the pace in coming down. How do you balance that from an economics point of view to make sure that you're still allowing for a bit more room in the economy? Obviously, as you said, there's so many other factors that they should be addressing as well, but how do you balance the interest rate side of it as well, because consumers and South Africans still have to live with those rates?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you can't just look at the last print on inflation and say that's the inflation rate, because there's much more. Inflation is a bit volatile, it's up and down. And of course, there are inflation expectations as well. And that is crucially important as well. So we talk about inflation currently around about 3%. But the actual underlying inflation rate in South Africa is more closer to about 4.5%, maybe a little bit below that. So don't look at the last print. That's the first point. The second point is that if you look at the inflation that we do have and the inflation we had the past couple of years, it's mostly because of administrative prices. And administrative prices are prices that are, well, administered by a bureaucrat somewhere or a politician somewhere. Things like, for example, electricity prices, local authority prices, or taxes that they levy, the fuel levy and things like that. And that's the reason why the Reserve Bank wants to have a lower inflation target in South Africa, because a lower inflation target will put the spotlight where it really matters, and that is on those administrative prices, like, for example, Eskom. Remember, they operate in an environment where they have no competition. The same goes for Transnet. The same goes for the local authorities. They simply they can do whatever they want to, because nobody is going to undercut them, because they are not in a competitive environment, unlike you and I, where we really have to work hard and compete with other similar agents in the economy doing the similar same sort of stuff that we are doing. That does not apply to the local authorities, as an example. So the problem in South Africa is that we've got the civil service, the local authorities or various levels of authority, like the state-owned enterprises, local authorities and institutions like that, and they are simply protected from competition, and they are very badly managed, and that's the reason why we have high inflation. So what we need to do, cut the inflation target in South Africa, bring it down eventually to 2%, put the spotlight where it's supposed to be, and that's on administrative prices, and tell everybody the reason that we have high inflation and high interest rates in South Africa is because of the mismanagement of the South African economy through, for example, unrealistic increases in administrative prices.
Shifting our focus, that's what we need to be doing. We need to be looking at certain things differently, and we need to be looking at them more practically and pragmatically. I think we'll leave the conversation there. Thanks so much, Mdavi. Mdavi Root, Chief Economist at Efficient Group, on the latest announcement by National Treasury to reduce some of the red tape around some of the public-private deals that will be taking place in South Africa, but also on the general state of where we stand as an economy.
Midnight Oil has a very distinct smell for business owners. Those who know will say it's got grit and graft. That's why Telkom Business wants to unleash the hero in you with the Business Fusion deal. Get a Packard Bell Montenero laptop, LTE 120 gigs anytime data, 120 gigs night surfer data, smart voice basic, plus a professional website for only 749 Rand per month. Call 10213, click telkom.co.za or go to any Telkom shop. TNC apply. Telkom. Possible begins here.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And as you mentioned, as you heard earlier in the show, we started looking at some of those potential at the time. Well, at the time the stories broke, they were impending tariffs. We have since gotten confirmation that they would be implemented, tariffs from the United States on steel and aluminium. And we're going to be taking a look at what those commodity tariffs mean for South Africa, but also potentially for the rest of the world. I'm joined on the line by Director for Mining at Modern Corporate Solutions, Peter Major, to take a look at this. Good evening, Peter. Lovely to catch up with you as always. Very interesting times that we are living in. Donald Trump is throwing a tariff toward everything.
Yeah, it seems to be, Jimmy. And when you figure out, there's probably 210 countries in the world, and I'm guessing the States probably trades with close to 200 of them. So I'm not sure if he's got a really big spreadsheet or if he's just throwing out blanket tariffs. Because if you read the small print in some of these announcements, it says he's looking at what each country is putting tariffs on from the States, and he's trying to match that. But geez, I don't know if he's matching commodity for commodity or machinery for machinery, or if he takes average tariffs at one country. This is really complex. You can imagine you got 200 countries on your x-axis, and then you probably got 20,000 products on your y-axis. So if you're doing a spreadsheet here, it can get complex and people can get lost really quick. I think what's going to happen is Donald likes to yell first, scare people, and then expect them to come running to him and say, okay, what's really irking you, Donald? Let's work it out. And that's usually what happens. Most of these countries seem to resolve things without much change from the status quo, as far as we know.
Peter, when we look at it from that perspective, how many times can President Trump realistically get away with it before the international community call him out on that by calling his bluff and effectively just saying, no, we're not going to budge this time?
Look, I think what we got to keep in mind is the U.S. is still the largest, richest country on the planet. China is not too far behind. So if you're any of the smaller countries, you don't really want to lose that market. You don't want to lose the first and second biggest buyer on the planet. So the world probably is going to go to close to unilateral negotiations. I think they have anyways. I think every country tries to get what's best for it. And that does make it complex. So if you're in America, whoever's dealing with your trade and industry, you know, is he doing unilateral trades one-on-one with 210 different countries? Or does he have some blankets? Does he say all metals imported into the country? I don't think so. I don't think it's that simple. So Donald likes to make things simple. But I think after he makes a statement like that, his advisors bring him the spreadsheets and the documents and they show him it's not that easy. We have to be more specific. And he'll probably tell him, okay, you guys sort it out. You know, I got the points on the board. You guys see how you can make him go higher for our benefit and lower for the other guy or something. I honestly don't know how it works, but it's a lot more complex than just what the headlines say.
Peter, when we look at the impact on South Africa, I mean, South Africa is a exporter of commodities into the world, not just into the United States. Are we anticipating that these tariffs are going to have a significant impact on some of our local commodity companies?
I think South African producers are pretty experienced and smart. And sanctions taught them they had to be like that.
So we have pretty broad markets, and we sell, most of our products are fairly basic. So they can go to almost any country, like chrome, gold, diamonds, PGMs, uranium, coal. So I don't think we're too much at risk. I think if Mr. Trump did put sanctions on any of our commodities, we'd have a pretty easy time selling them to somebody else who's just going to act as a middleman. And most of your audience isn't as old as me, but I can remember when Russia led the charge in 1979, 1978 against Rhodesia. And they humiliated the states and the UK, saying, how can you be doing business with such a racist regime? And yet, when the West did stop buying chrome from Rhodesia, well, the Russians took it all. And naturally, they couldn't use it all, so they passed it on to the U.S. and Great Britain and the rest of the West. Obviously, they passed it on at a surcharge, you know, to make up for their effort. So I don't think South Africa would have a very hard time if the U.S. just flat out stopped buying our commodities. If they stopped buying certain products, then it would have a bigger jolt, like maybe some of our steel. But even then, we're so diversified in our markets, I think we'd survive it pretty easy.
Mm. Peter, some have argued that things like tariffs, particularly the kinds of tariffs that Donald Trump has been talking about for the longest time, only seem to make things more expensive in the US. And if you are to promote localization of industries and bring things back into the US, does the US have capacity to be able to localize every single industry and every single sector that Donald intends to put a tariff on?
I think they could eventually get the capacity, but you're right, Jimmy. It's going to be a heck of a jolt, because my experience in the States is if you're selling a can of beans for $1 and it's locally produced, and if the Chinese or the Mexicans or Canadians can make that can at 95 cents, most Americans I know go for the one at 95 cents. It's pretty hard getting the average American to buy local. They all think they're doing it, you know, they're really saving money. They're not that patriotic from what I've seen. Now, Donald may find ways of making them more patriotic. You know, if the whole world's against them, they might start doing that. But the patriotism we saw in World War II was pretty unprecedented. Then everybody is rallying to the cause. We're fighting a world war on both sides. But yeah, my experience there in the 60s, 70s, 80s, right up until now, the average American seems to have no problem buying something foreign, even if he just saves 2%, 3%. They're not very patriotic.
How will these savings then be impacted by the imported inflation that comes of these tariffs? I mean, alongside all of that is the cost of production can't remain at the same price, surely?
No, you're right. If they actually raise tariffs high enough to justify local production, you're going to have a rise in inflation without a doubt. So if because America does import more than any country on the planet, putting tariffs on most of those imports, I would think it'd have a pretty immediate knock on inflation. And I think that's why the Reserve Bank Chairman Jerome Powell is not in a rush to cut rates just yet. He wants to see what effect these tariffs have. How many tariffs are we going to have and how high are they going to be? Because they will definitely increase inflation in the States.
The global picture is getting messier and messier by the day, all thanks to President Donald Trump. We'll leave the conversation there, Peter. Thanks so much, as always, for the time and for the insights. Peter Major, Director for Mining at Modern Corporate Solutions, joining us to take a look at the latest round of tariffs on steel and aluminium implemented by President Donald Trump and his administration.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The team at BMW South Africa launched the new X3 today. There will be another look at that next week, but we're going to be taking a look at the production facility in Rosslyn. That facility has been around for quite some time, and it has been contributing towards the local and international part of BMW. I'm joined on the line by the General Manager for Quality at BMW South Africa's Rosslyn plant, Ernest Kohlmeyer, to take a look at this and see if we can get an understanding of what's happening with the business. Good evening, Ernest. Thanks so much for taking the time. successful launch of the new 3 Series model, but more than that, it's a reaffirmation of the commitment that BMW has made towards continuing to produce vehicles out of that Rosslyn plant and continuing to contribute towards the automotive sector.
Yes, surely something that we're very excited about. Good evening, Jimmy, and to all. With the investment that we started making roughly 2 years ago, $4.2 billion, and we are in the launch phase. And as you've mentioned, we had the media launch kicked off today. We started production actually in October last year already, and all is going well.
Ernest, when you are looking at the plant in Rosslyn, I mean, for years that plant has produced things like the 3 Series, other models of BMW. Now to transition that plant into kind of a hybrid production plant / EV plant, I remember those conversations started a couple of years ago, and we kind of touched base on that last year with the team at BMW to say that was something that the business wanted to look at from a group perspective. How is that transition shaping up from a production point of view and from a plant development point of view?
Yeah, so for plant development, that is key at the moment in the automotive sector. We stand for sustainability, and then to electrify the plant in South Africa is really, first of all, something that we are very proud of, and also the commitment that we will produce the plug-in hybrid electric vehicle only here from plant Rosslyn. So the development has gone well. The preparations have gone well. We started 3 years ago already with the training of our associates. So it's upskilling of associates, upliftment of the associates, and with that, even the community, because we will obviously with this also push infrastructure in our country.
Mm.
I hope so, yeah.
I remember when that 4 billion rand investment was announced around electrification and digitization of the facility. It was a big announcement and a big commitment. I think it was in the previous administration's investment drive as well, or around the overlap between the previous and the current administration. But it was a firm commitment from BMW to say that not only will we continue with our combustion engine variants in this plant, but we're also going to be looking to expand on that. How are you seeing the demand shaping up for the vehicles both locally and abroad, because I know that that plant does also provide some of the products, or the output also does get shipped outside of South Africa?
Yeah, so the demand for the vehicle is to such a point that our schedule is full for the year. So currently planning 75,000 cars to be produced this year. 97% of those cars will be exported. Main focus there is the European markets, Germany and Great Britain. And exporting to additional over 30 other markets as well. So that's the current situation. The demand of the for the vehicle is really excellent and sold out in South Africa.
Mm. Ernest, the fact that you're exporting 90% of, or 97% of the vehicles outside of the country clearly means that the quality that comes out of that plant is of the international standards that BMW needs to produce. And I mean, as quality manager for that particular plant, that's something you definitely want to be proud of.
Yes, it is. World-class quality is something that we produce, and we work with world-class production. So world-class associates are required for that. And our focus is, you know, we are a premium manufacturer. Our customers have no other expectation than to receive premium quality vehicles. And we are surely proud of that. And we have made a statement with this as well, towards the BMW group, that we can compete with those outside of South Africa. And we are producing the vehicles on quality levels as per those requirements.
Mm. Speaking of competition, Ernest, do you have an idea of how your plug-in hybrids are faring up or stacking up against the market in terms of just where they sit? I mean, obviously the X3 sits in a particular market segment, and you guys have other competitors that might be looking at something similar. How do you gauge your performance of something like a plug-in hybrid as opposed to the traditional combustion engines that you guys have had?
Yeah, so in the detail of the market numbers and the sales, I can't really give you an answer on that. But what I can really say is that if we look at the split between the vehicle production in the plant, you know, 60% at the moment is for the internal combustion engines, so the well-known petrol and diesel engines. 40% thereof is for the plug-in hybrid electric vehicle. So, and that is really because of the demand of the car. So there is for sure a pull on this new product. And I think it's an excellent product to bridge the complete EV electric vehicle between that and the normal petrol engine and diesel engines that everybody is so used to. So it's a phenomenal product and an amazing bridge between the two.
But it also does demonstrate, Ernest, that BMW has the capacity to kind of be flexible and adaptable towards whatever the customer base requires, but also what you're looking to do from a business perspective. Does this mean that we could potentially see the plant being expanded into more models, more variations? I mean, you're clearly evidencing to the group that you can handle the demands, you can handle the requirements that are being placed on it.
I believe that the automotive industry at the moment is in quite a dynamic environment. So to make any statement on that now will be looking into a crystal ball, which is something that I don't want to do. So the focus that we currently have is really to deliver the premium quality from this plant and to deliver the maximum volume. So looking into the years ahead, I believe that we will be able to reach even our maximum capacity of 77,000 cars in a year, which we will build with the three shifts and the roughly 2,500 associates in the plant.
By all accounts, the BMW Roslyn plant is doing exceptionally well and will continue to do so for the foreseeable future. We wish you and the team the best of luck, Ernest. Thanks so much for that update and for the time. That's Ernest Kohlmeier, who is the General Manager of Quality at the BMW Group South Africa, joining us to take a look at the launch of the latest X3 model, but also give us an update around how that Roslyn plant is performing.
There's a song that goes, "Money can't buy me love." And that's true. But then they told us all you need is love, which anybody with a mortgage will tell you most certainly is not true. Love won't pay your parking tickets or your student loan. It's also needy. It requires effort, availability, constant care. But more importantly, love requires time. And while money can't buy you love, it can certainly free up some of your time. Time to spend on the things you love with the people you love. And if you're looking, maybe even time to find the one you love. That's why, after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do the things you love. And don't you love that about investing? Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.
The Property Pod.
South Africa's new Expropriation Act hit the international headlines last week after US President Donald Trump launched a broadside on the issue. On the latest episode of the Property Pod on MoneyWeb, we look at the Expropriation Act from the side of the residential property sector. Samuel Seif, chairperson of Seif Property Group, weighs in on why he is not too worried about the act impacting the industry.
The Property Pod.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And it's Agri Tuesday's turn this week. Last week we had Property Tuesday. This week is Agri Tuesday. We're going to be taking a look at a very strange phenomenon that seems to be affecting the citrus market in South Africa. And that is a significant sector of the agricultural exports that we have. In particular, we're looking at papaya orchards that sit in Limpopo and Mpumalanga. There seems to be a very serious case of bud rot that's happening there. We're joined on the line by the Director of Dispute Resolution at Cliffdecker Hofmeyer to take a look at this and see if we can understand the impact of this strange phenomenon. Lucinda Ruedi joins me on the line now. Good evening, Lucinda. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start by getting a bit of an understanding around what's happening here. What do we mean by bud rot and what's going on?
Yes, good evening, Jimmy, and good evening to your listeners. Yeah, you know, bud rot is also known as grey mold, and it is a type of mold that, strangely enough, generally affects cannabis plants, particularly during the flowering stage, and it is caused by some other fungus that strives in settings with very high humidity, poor air circulation. And once this bud rot develops, it actually obstructs the proper transportation of water and nutrients through the leaves and flowers. So you can now just imagine that this outbreak in papaya orchards are going to have a huge impact on the quality of the papayas that are produced, and also the very high risk of spreading this bud rot if you do transport papayas that are infected by this bud rot. And this is, of course, what caused all of the problems, because our government, in accordance with their obligations as being part of the National Plant Protection Organization and Convention, disclosed this to our export markets, as they were obliged to do, and that had a ripple effect down to so far that to date both Botswana and Namibia have temporarily suspended their imports of papayas. So that is a very high level overview of what is going on here.
Now, Lucinda, South Africa is a significant exporter of citrus. If I'm not mistaken, I think we're the second largest exporter of citrus in the world. That clearly means that this is a problem that has a significant impact on agricultural trade, on the exports that we put out there. Can you give us just a sense of how significant this impact is?
I don't have all the data to give you this, you know, give you the percentages, but as I say, already Botswana and Namibia has temporarily suspended their imports. And you can imagine the impact that it has on our economy. I'm sure that unless this bud rot infestation is brought under control and the government puts out the necessary further notifications to allay fears, that impact is just going to grow more significant, having an impact on the farmers particularly that may now sit with an oversupply of products in South Africa that's going to drive the prices down. Good news for the consumer in the street, unfortunately not so good news for the farmers and the exporters.
The other side of it for the farmers, I suppose, Lucinda, is the fact that they would also be subject to or potentially exposed to some losses and some legal claims or some liabilities that they could be in for. Because, I mean, if you have amounts that you've committed in terms of supply agreements and you're not able to honor those agreements, that's one side of it. But the other side of it is if there is some significant delay from a production point of view, from an export point of view, your entire production could be affected. You could be required to move some of your trees. Can we just look at, from a farmer's perspective, what farmers might need to do here to safeguard some of their crops against this rot?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of ways that one can look at it. Firstly, the farmers need to go and inspect and consider very carefully their own insurance to see whether their insurance contracts cover these type of or this type of situation that they faced with. Then we must remember that the sale and the import, the export of agricultural products are heavily legislated. And one can look at, for instance, the Plant Improvement Act, there's the Agricultural Pests Act. So farmers not only risk civil claims by their contractual counterparties like purchasers and consumers, but also they face risks from a regulatory perspective. So farmers firstly must be very cognizant of the permits that they have and the permits or the permit conditions that's attached to those permits, because any act or omission on the part of farmers not complying with permit conditions, not complying with any regulations which government may promulgate to stem the spread of this bud rot, could lead to contraventions by the farmers of certain legislation, which could in turn lead to loss of permits, loss of licenses, penalties, fines, and possibly even imprisonment, depending on how they contravene the act. So that's from a regulatory perspective. But remember, farmers are also in civil contractual relationships with third parties, as you correctly say. They may have export and supply agreements with foreign entities, but also South African entities. They may be supplying product to retailers, to restaurants, to supermarkets, and they may also be selling to the man on the street. You know, the typical farmer's stall that you get across, you know, along the roadside when you're entering into farm country. So from that perspective, farmers must be extremely cautious of what their contract says. Because if they cannot supply the product that they guaranteed, or if they supply a product which we are going to call defective, they open themselves up to losing that contract because it will be a breach, and their end customer might cancel it. The contract may have penalty clauses in it if, as you say, there's a late supply or a delay in supply, and ultimately it can lead to damages. But more importantly, the loss of income, which the farmer will suffer if those contracts are cancelled. So those are the type of risks that farmers must be cognizant of. Also, if they sell to the man in the street, they may or may not breach or contravene certain provisions of the Consumer Protection Act, which could ultimately lead to a complaint at the National Consumer Commission. So this is really a very serious situation which the farmers are finding themselves in.
Mm. Listen, you mentioned a couple of things around the legal side of it, and I wonder, can we just look at that from a farmer's perspective? I mean, legal liabilities, you touched on things like having insurance in place, but how serious is it from a legal liability perspective if this continues? Because, I mean, for some farmers, this is, or actually for all farmers, this is likely out of their control, but they could still be subject to some legal claims.
Yes, and Jimmy, again, one will have to look at what the terms of a farmer's specific agreement is. One term that came up a lot during the pandemic was force majeure. Is the outbreak of a disease like this, which is entirely outside of the control of a farmer, would that release the farmer, albeit temporarily, from its contractual obligations to, for instance, deliver a minimum number of product to end customer? So one can take forever to discuss the legal risks, but it will ultimately come down to what is the contractual term that the farmer bound itself to when it entered into supply agreement, and what is the consequences if the farmer cannot comply with those requirements. So that is a huge risk. And I think very importantly, farmers must be advised that if they are aware of an outbreak of bud rot, if they are aware that this is present in their orchards, they must disclose it. If they fail to disclose this to their contracting parties, that constitutes a misrepresentation, which also affords the opposing contracting party the right to claim damages, because that contracting party will then, based on this misrepresentation, purchase papayas that may be infested with this bud rot. So those are the type of things that farmers need to look out for and seek advice if they're unsure what their risks and liabilities may be.
Seek advice, farmers, if you are in this pickle. For those that are out there that are consumers of the papaya and you suddenly find papaya prices are cheaper, now you know why. Hopefully we can get this resolved and we can get to the bottom of this as soon as possible. For those that are in government that need to do their part to help protect our farmers and our agricultural sector, please do your part. We'll leave the conversation there. Lucinda, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Lucinda Rodi, who is the Director for Dispute Resolution at Cliffdekker Hofmeyr, joining us to take a look at the latest potential scare for farmers in the form of bud rot.
Affordable data is more than just a convenience. It's a real catalyst for change. In the latest Fix SA episode, I talked to George Mendez, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Cell C, about the telco industry's role in driving inclusive economic growth. From empowering underserved communities to fostering entrepreneurship, connectivity is unlocking potential and creating opportunities.
Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
My name is Frank Leonet, CEO and founder of South Africa's newest crypto exchange called Afridex. I will be on the MoneyWeb crypto podcast with Karen Ryan to explain why we believe South Africa could benefit from a new crypto exchange and how we differ from the existing exchanges. Join us this week to find out more.
Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb crypto podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za. The MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
And we've come to the end of the show, folks. Thanks for tuning in. If you've missed any of the conversations, you know exactly where you can catch up on them. They will be put up online on all of our various platforms. You can listen to the podcasts from tomorrow morning. It's coming up to 7 o'clock, so Greg Coase is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team. That also means from my side, good night.